supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
The loss of coal in the industry was basically the economic turndown that started long, long time ago. And as you guys know in your research, you know that none of this happens overnight.
I'm Naomi Starobin, and this is Grapple.
Coal's heyday, turn of the century. So early 1900s, we had over 15,000 people in this same footprint of where the town is now. We now have 4,000 people. 26-27% of our homes are vacant.
Monoy City is a small town tucked away in northeastern Pennsylvania's coal country. And on the way there, along Route 54, there's this pipeline-looking structure that crosses above the road. And there's a phrase on it. It says, "Coal keeps the lights on." Back in the day, that might have been true. But today, it's like an insulting joke, especially when you consider the decline of the coal industry. And then as you go a little farther down the road, just around the bend, you come up to an enormous and dilapidated building.
An old coal breaker, the last of its kind in the state of PA, is coming down. But plenty of people want to get a look before it's gone.
It's the St. Nicholas Coal Breaker, and it's full of broken windows with birds flying through. You can see hanging light fixtures and stairwells and remains of what used to be really a pulsating building. Now it just sits there, like a ghost tending to the past. It's a symbol of when coal ruled this town, but now a haunting reminder of its downfall.
Live near Monoy City, Suzanne.
The breaker closed in the 1960s, and now its owner, the Redding Anthracite Company, is taking it down. When it opened in 1931, the St. Nicholas Breaker outside Monoy City was an automated marvel, said to be the largest of its kind in the world.
It's a marker to the past that shows how important this area.
As people drive by on Route 54 on their way into Monoy City, it's an uncomfortable preview of what lies ahead.
There's a lot of houses falling apart and a bunch that had caught fire that nobody has done anything with, so they're just sitting there half burnt. So it seems like the town's kind of falling apart.
Sure, the town has its share of well-kept row homes, proudly decorated front porches, and American flags. But within blocks, rundown properties do stick out, with red and white notices about violations or hazards inside. And there are homes completely abandoned, just wasting away. Blight. It's a big problem in Monoy City, especially for those living next to it, like Jim Rhodes.
I just bought a property next to me. I have to demo that. It's going to cost me about $20,000. And I paid $1,000 for it through the tax claim sale, but I have to invest that just to keep blight away from me. So I'll take it down just to keep it from falling down on my house because there was tar paper and wood and things falling all the time.
Rhodes grew up in Monoy City, and he's seen the town change over time.
There's no one easy fix. You know, we don't have the jobs to keep a stock of people with the money and the resources to invest in their homes and keep them up. And if one falls down or breaks, you can just go move down the street to another one. They're cheap. You know, $8,000 is our assessed. You can buy a house in town for $10,000-$15,000 that's livable. So it's kind of crazy.
Rhodes makes his living as a municipal engineer for a private company that works with the town. He took our reporter, Lindsay Lazarski, and executive producer Stephanie Marudis on a tour.
And if you look around, you know, in any block, you can find a few homes, you know, here, right here. Two properties here that obviously are blighted with boarded up windows, the roof falling down, obvious water damage. That building hasn't been maintained for years. I'm sure the borough has cited people and they could have had the magistrate judge against the homeowners, but there's still money needed to demolish the building, and that owner's not doing it.
You see a man and child, like, right next door.
Yeah, and that's, there's kids all around here. You're, looking at that roof, you know, there's a potential it can fall down, and there's imminent danger to people from these blighted structures. The ones that, you know, there is an imminent threat and, you know, the borough will call the engineers or a building inspector in to look at something. And if we determine that there's an imminent threat, then the borough steps in and takes care of it, you know, regardless of what it costs. They do that for the public. But that really shouldn't be the borough's job, that private property owners should be maintaining their property, and that the limited money, the resources the borough has are taking care of something they shouldn't be. There's three more houses there that are vacant. We can do that around the whole town. It's like if you see that empty gap between row homes, that's somebody brought it down and like there they did a nice job of landscaping it. To the left here, these properties, there's a big fire there. That's another one where the owners don't have the capability of taking the building down.
How long has it been like that, do you think, Jim?
That has been like that for eight years for that one. Here's the big fire. Now you look at those, they have to come down. That's kids walking in there, playing in there, going in, rummaging for stuff.
Was it like that when you were growing up? Or is that just more recent that you just see more of these, you know, burned out buildings?
Yeah, the blight was here years ago. You know, growing up we saw them, but just not to the degree of what we have now. When I was young in the 70s and 80s, now our population was double what it is now. So we didn't have as many vacant properties. So people were there and taking care of them. So it definitely wasn't as prevalent. So we had a church, a fire company, or a bar on every corner. Now, we obviously don't have as much as we did before, but the churches had consolidated because not as many people living here, not as many people going to church. The fire companies have consolidated to a degree for the same reasons, because you have less volunteers. And then the bar rooms, there's a lot less people drinking, living here, not as many people working that have the money to, you know, go out and drink. So we definitely have a lot less bars than we used to, too. But yeah, turn of the century, we supposedly had more bar rooms per capita than most places in the United States.
Somebody once said, what's happened to some Pennsylvania towns, it's like a slow motion disaster. You know, you think about a hurricane, a natural disaster, and it comes in and the impact is the same.
Sure.
It's just slow.
Slow enough that even some people don't see it coming, and it may have been an economic crisis that started the ball rolling with losing jobs, coal industry, you know, basically shuts down. You had all, you know, most of the people here working in that industry, or the industry around all those people working, because they had to eat, they had to drink, they, you know, the butcher shops, the supermarkets on every corner. It's now an economic problem because of the people here have to pay for it. Again, losing the value in their own homes, but the tax money that's going to fix it, or them themselves trying to step up and knock down a home next to them and keep it.
What's happening to your young people here? What are they doing after they go to high school?
Quite frankly, most of them are moving out of the area. We have some that come back and some are still tied to family, but in order to get a decent paying job in their field, we just don't have the jobs here.
There is some coal, right?
Yeah, there's still a little bit of coal, not as much, not big numbers. You know, there's a lot of people hired at the school. We have a lot of people, there's a couple hospitals, but a lot of people are traveling. A lot of people are, you know, we're not within 15 minutes. We have prisons. I know quite a few prison guards. And quite frankly, there's a lot of prisoner families that have moved into our area from outside of the area when prisoners get put in here. We've had an influx since then of people from out of the area that want to be by their loved one in the prison.
And what do you think about that?
Good and bad. There's been issues with some of them, you know, from not maintaining properties. You know, but everybody deserves a fair chance to live where they want. It's those that don't upkeep their properties and add to blight that I have a problem with. However, that's not just people that come in from out of the area. We have local people that don't take care of their stuff either. Now here we come up on the Kyers Brewery. This is actually going to be a success story for us. So obviously it's blighted. You know, you can see You want to get out and take a walk around?
Yeah, let's do that.
This, as I mentioned, is going to be a success story because the borough obtained three different grants in order to bring this down. So we're going to demolish it, hopefully this year. Once it's knocked down, then this will become a park. It's valuable property, valuable land. It's in an area where we have some residents. We have some businesses here. So you get some traffic going up to the park. You can stop in those businesses, and that's the start of something good.
Anything you want to say about what this place means to you?
It's home. It feels good. It's family, and there's a comfort level. My wife and I are both active in different groups in the community, and you know, we do our best to make it a good place. But there's still a sense of community. There's still a sense of pride with people. It may not be as prevalent as it was, you know, back in the day, as people say, but it's still here. And I don't think Monte City is unique in the situation we're in. I think there's a lot of areas in the United States that are in a similar situation, and you know, there's no easy solution. So you just kind of got to make the best of it and do what you can to you know, make it a better place. Despite the negative of blight, you know, we still see there's good things that could come out of it. So if we can keep fighting this and get to a point where, you know, we can stop it from happening to the good homes now and then figure out a way to go after the old ones, you know, I still think there's a chance we can save the city.
When Lindsay and our other reporter, Emily Previty, first started going to Monte City, they saw ruins of a big fire right along Center Street, which is the main street in town. And within the debris, they spotted a kid's toy chest. It had the name Anthony on it, and there were children's pajamas on the ground near it. After some research, they found out the fire had taken place a year and a half earlier. The damaged homes just sat there, waiting to be demolished or rehabbed. Emily and Lindsay looked for fire victims on the block to talk to, and they ended up finding Susie Kester. After the fire, she and her husband spent almost 9 months in a hotel until the contractors could finish fixing their home.
I guess let's start the night of the fire, or I guess it was the daytime. What?
It was around 6 o'clock in the evening, yes.
And where were you?
I was at my cousin's, supposedly to get tires on my car, and he's a fireman. And the call came in, and I shot down here. I was here before the firemen were even here.
And what did you see when you got here?
I just saw smoke. That's all I saw. But I knew it was close. My husband was in here and watching TV, and I said, we got to get out.
As you guys went outside, what were you seeing? What were you hearing?
Oh, just the firemen saying it was bad. It got a good start. I don't know how, because I left here 10 minutes before. Saw nothing.
And how long were you out of the house?
1 week short of 9 months.
And so where did you stay again?
We stayed at the hotel up at the top of the hill, the Mainstay Suites.
How much did that cost?
The insurance covered every last penny of it. What was very hard on me was living up at the hotel. First of all, yeah, it was an efficiency. There was a stove and a refrigerator, but the stove was just big. I love to cook. I love to entertain. I always had my Thanksgiving, Easter, Christmas. The year we were out, couldn't do that, okay? Between what the insurance company paid the people to fix this house and our stay up at the Mainstay, it was approximately $55,000. Give me $55,000. I could buy 4 houses in this town.
So you would have been happy with something like
oh,
that?
Oh, I would have been thrilled. I would have been absolutely thrilled with it. Because we're not happy here now. We're having more problems. But it would be, if I tried to sell it, I would probably start at $25,000.
And after all the money that you've put into it, to address all the problems too. It's like, would you get that back?
Yeah. And then we had beautiful hardwood floors in our living room. I mean, they were gorgeous. And I kept up with them, okay? As a matter of fact, when we first bought this house, My husband was a manager at Rite Aid. And when we first bought the house, they had those heavy waxing machines. And before we moved in, he waxed them. Oh, my God, they were beautiful. They shone. They were absolutely gorgeous. But with the fire, with the leakage, with the firemen traipsing in and out, they were ruined. And so we put the carpeting in. But I miss my hardwood floors. I really do. They were gorgeous.
But what would you say is the hardest part on you?
Just not knowing every day what we're going to find. I mean, seriously. See, I cry a lot. I do. I cry.
Yeah, I don't know. It's, I guess what I'm thinking about is that night when you were up on the hill, did you expect any of this?
No. Oh, gosh, no. No, I thought maybe we'd be 2 or 3 months, you know. But it's just, they just kept hitting one snag after another. And
so things have really changed.
Oh, dramatically. I cry. I mean, I think, what am I going to wake up to tomorrow?
I wanted to ask some more questions about what it used to be like in this town. So you said you grew up just a couple blocks away. Is that right?
The next block.
Next block.
So if, when you go out, there's a fabric store there. My parents were the owners of that. That's where I grew up.
What did the street used to look like?
Oh, my gosh. They used to be clean. Oh, yeah. People took pride in their properties.
But what about in terms of, like, different businesses that might have been?
Oh, there was, too many. We had, when I was growing up, we had 3 shoe stores. We had 2 or 3 women's department stores. We had 2 or 3 men's stores. We had 2 5 and Dimes, which is like a Woolworths or Newberry's. I think we had about 5 small, individually owned drug stores. We had scads of churches, scads of bars. If you see the building with the green, okay, I lived there. That was my parents, and they had 2 beautiful apartments. But look at it now. It's going to pieces.
A few months after interviewing Susie Kester, we went back to where her house is. The destroyed home next to hers had finally been knocked down. Grass was growing on the site. And some municipal workers were tending to a tree on the sidewalk. On the other side of the lot, there were still houses in ruins, unsecured, posing a risk as children walked by on their way home from school. And as we talked to people around town, we heard more and more stories about other fires that had taken place. We could see how fires really do rip very easily through the densely packed wooden row homes. Like this story from Cheryl Herring, who told Emily and Lindsay about a fire on her block that happened several years ago.
I heard 3 pops, and I went back to sleep. And then my smoke alarm started going off. And by the time I got out my front door, the house 7 away from me, the whole front wall was just orange flame. And we could never find out what the cause was because within 3 days the house was gone. What was left of it, which wasn't much.
Your house was gone?
No, mine structurally was sound enough, but I had that much soot and smoke and water damage, they had to gut it to the studs.
And so how much did insurance cover that for you?
Not everything.
How much did you have to pay out of pocket?
Well, I had to buy all the paneling that I wanted back in. I'd say close to $10,000 out of pocket besides what my insurance paid. And that was 80-some thousand. Where the fire started and the next 3 houses up, they all had to be torn down. But the last 3, and I'm on the end, I'm considered an end property, we were gutted to our studs. I mean, when I opened my front door, I could see everything for the 3 houses.
And what are some of the things that you lost that you couldn't get back?
Well, I lost my husband in 96, and he and I paneled every room in our house together on the inside.
Hello?
When I walked in and I saw them, I had to get everything ripped out. It was like I was reburying him all over again because everything we'd done together was gone. And when I walked back in the house as a finished product, it was no longer a home. It was just a house where I slept. Because I just felt it was it was taken away from me for the second time. He used to make tapes. I wanted them back. They said they were going to put them on CDs. I didn't get them back. We were into Southern gospel and not the hard rock and roll, but the old-time rock and roll. Late 40s, 50s, and 60s.
Well, that's an example of an artist.
Or a song that you guys used to listen to.
Oh, geez. Well, The Book of Love, Bobby's Girl, like Rick Nelson and Bobby Rydell, and you don't know any of them songs.
No, I do. Bobby Rydell.
Between fire and blight, lots of buildings have disappeared in Mahanoy City, and residents remember them, like the Victoria Movie Theater. Angela Price remembers going to see a movie there in the late 1970s.
It was me and my aunt. We went and saw Superman. That was the first movie I ever saw in there. You know, my husband, as a matter of fact, he just got pictures on his Facebook from the old Victorian. You know, they closed it down and they knocked down the building and... You know, like now you have to go all the way up to the mall just to go watch a movie.
We met Angela Price sitting out on her front porch. She says she loves her hometown and she plans to stay. But she also says it's getting harder and harder to live there.
The only trouble that we do have is the drugs, you know, and a lot of the old houses that they're not doing nothing with them. You know, a lot of them are falling down and people are going to be getting hurt if they don't take care of it. You know, like these two houses here, we actually had a leak in our house because of this house over here. And our attic roof fell in because of people not knocking them down or, you know, doing what they have to do with them. They are trying to clean up with the drug business. I mean, because it was getting bad there for a while. A couple of our friends just passed away from overdoses. You know, especially like when you're starting to lose family members and stuff. That's what bothers us. And I think we should have a lot more, which, I mean, it is a small area, but a lot more places for people to work. We have to actually travel just to work. I don't like traveling. I have to go like to Hazleton, to Pottsville, and in the weather it's bad, you know, so I really don't like traveling. My husband, he doesn't work. He's been disabled and stuff, so I am like the breadwinner of the house, and trying to take care of a house and a family, it's tough trying to go and get a good job where they pay half decent.
What kind of work do you do, Angela?
Certified nursing assistant. I've been that for 20 years.
You grew up here. What did your family do for work?
There used to be a factory down where they built the new high school. My mom and dad worked down there. It was like a shirt company. They would make shirts and, you know, they moved to Mexico. And after that, a lot of people lost jobs from that. And like my mom, like now my mom's bartending because there's really nothing around here. She doesn't drive. The biggest thing is, like, you know, there's not a lot of danger around here and stuff like that. And that's what we really like about. Like, we talk about always moving and stuff, but I don't think we'd ever will. They just have to clean it up a bit.
Unlike Angela Price, who's lived in Mahanoy City her whole life, Janelle Heiss is a relative newcomer. She grew up in Chester, which is in southeastern Pennsylvania, and then lived in Philadelphia. She sees this area as a place where she and her family can work for themselves and enjoy a decent standard of living. One of their businesses is catering.
But right now we're doing dinner platters. We deliver them, try to deliver them the best way we can. We are working on a vehicle for us to deliver. We are staying. We are officially staying. The environment. We love the houses. It's like very easy to get a house down here. We just got recently 6 properties all together down here that we own. It's always like a new start for me, a new beginning. I sit outside in the backyard and just look at the stars in my yard and just breathtaking.
But for Travis John, who grew up in Mahanoy City, well, he sees no future for himself in the area. He spoke with Stephanie and Lindsay as they worked on a roof with another guy.
Get this one done, then we gotta do the one over here another day. It's like an apartment house. My grandma owns it. So we live here with her to help her out, you know. Nothing to do up here. Yeah, nothing to do at all up here.
Did you go to high school here?
Yeah, I graduated.
What'd you do afterwards?
Working at, like, industries in that, like building trailers.
Do you see yourself being able to make it here?
Nah, I've been in and out of jail, getting in trouble here, you know.
What's next? Are you gonna stay or?
Yeah, I have a little kid and I'm helping my mom right now, like with the bills and that. Till we find something better. Something out of this county, you know. It's a rough county.
Tom Seiberling isn't too upbeat either about the future of Mahanoy City and the surrounding Schuylkill County. He was a longtime school librarian, and now he's the director of the local public library.
Well, a lot of problems I see. There's too many single parents, too many kids are foster kids, and a lot of these children don't have any guidance. If they had a lot of guidance, maybe somebody read a story to them at night, or somebody get a library choir and bring them to the library. So they have the opportunity to read and to learn. But without that kind of support, it's very hard to do. The biggest thing in Schuylkill County overall, even not only Monty City, is we don't have any industry. And without industry, you have no opportunities for people to get money to pay for the luxury they want, maybe a house or a car or whatever. My two sons moved to Philadelphia and Hanover, and one's a lawyer and one's a CEO, because there's no opportunity and financial reward around here. That's the reason why young people don't stay here. There's no industry, nothing to keep people here. Even the malls. The malls are losing people every week to two big chain stores. Without those, hey, the malls are even falling apart. There's going to be eventually no place for anybody even to get their groceries and necessities. So it's not good for Schuylkill County. Everybody looks at Schuylkill County as a depressed area.
Now let's turn to Dan Lynch. He thinks a lot about the region and its economic situation. He grew up in the area, and today he's the borough manager of Mahanoy City. And that's basically like being the captain of a sinking ship.
You walk in through the door knowing the town is struggling, because every town in the area is struggling. You know, the first thing I notice is, you know, the borough really just gets by most years and tries to keep things as run as smoothly and cheaply as possible, because they do understand a lot of the population is elderly, a lot of the population is lower income, so they don't want to run right out and say, well, we'll just raise taxes. So over the years, and even while I've been here, as people retired or left because of injury or disability, they sometimes didn't replace the position. You know, you can go back in the 90s and they had 16 guys working on their street crew, where we have three now. And look back in old photographs of the police, there's 14, 15 full-time cops, now there's three. I mean, they've pared down the operation as the town has shrunk in turn. And it kind of creates a problem because you are able to do less and less with a town that's not getting any smaller, with the infrastructure maybe getting worse and worse because you don't have the funds to keep it up to the standards you might want. So that's pressing because you're trying to keep up, essentially. Collectively, if you're looking at this area, this region, it's not unlike a city like Detroit, where they had a loss of industry, which led to entire sections being, you know, slowly given over to blight as the jobs leave. So without an excess or a number of jobs to bring people in, you get overstocked, and then slowly, you know, blight builds up, and it has a sickness-like effect. You know, if you have one blighted house on the block, it has a tendency to spread. It does damage to the adjoining structures, and it just goes from there, and it becomes difficult. And then as your housing prices drop, you tend to, you know, you will have a population that may not have the ability to keep the necessary upkeep on their home. So they, you know, a $10,000 investment to maintain a home might be too much for a widower or somebody who's very low income. So then when they leave that home, it's already in a sort of a state of disrepair. So there's no incentive to rehabilitate, and then it can very quickly go from teetering on the brink to too far gone. Having jobs in the area is important. You know, we had a business move in called Fabcon. That's a good employer for the area. They make concrete panels, and it's a good paying job. a few years ago, there was a lot of talk about a potential cargo airport in Luzerne County. And I think that's completely dead now. It was fighting a long legal battle, but that goes back 10 years. Something of that where there's going to be, you know, 1,000 jobs or 1,500 jobs would be huge for this area because we just have a tremendous amount of vacant houses and low home values. So if you get good employment in the area, you can raise those up. And that would help spur, you know, the local economy.
And as we just heard from Dan Lynch, Monoy City has been bogged down with unexpected spending. They've had to demolish blighted homes, and that's caused some major budget problems, to the point where, earlier this year, the town actually entered into a financial oversight program for distressed municipalities in Pennsylvania. The goal of that is to come up with a recovery plan and to pump in some loans and grants and hopefully see some results down the road. But it's too hard to know at this point in time whether Monoy City can turn itself around. As we head out of town now, back on Route 54, a farewell wave to the rundown St. Nicholas Coal Breaker. And there's that haunting sign again, Coal Keeps the Lights On. Relics from a bygone era, along with this coal mining-inspired poem that we're about to hear. It was written in Monoy City at the beginning of the 20th century by a local priest named Emil Kubek. A Yale graduate student named Nick Kupensky has translated some of Kubek's poems as part of his research on the lives and stories of Slavic immigrants in Pennsylvania's coal region.
In 1904, he comes to Monoy City to serve in St. Mary's Byzantine Catholic Church. And as far as I could tell, this is the first poem that Kubek ever wrote. It was likely written in 1907, which is 3 years after he emigrated to Monoy City. What makes Lullaby to a Miner's Child so unique is that this poem is absolutely about the trials and tribulations of his coal mining parishioners. So the reason why I decided to translate it is because even though this poem was originally written in Carpathian Rusyn, it's absolutely a poem about Monoy City, about the workers of Monoy City. So this Lullaby to a Miner's Child is, you know, about all of the individuals who Kubek interacted with, and in a sort of broader sense, is about all of the individuals who suffered and labored or were injured or lost their lives in the mines. Lullaby to a Miner's Child by Emil Kubek. O sleep, my sweet child, underneath the ground bursts. Do you hear the terrible noise of the earth? Your father is working in the mines, oh, so deep. When the earth shakes, that's him who rocks you to sleep. Oh, sleep, my sweet child. That noise, it's your dad. From under the earth, he's bringing home bread. Deep in the mines, he works as hard as he can, while peacefully dreams his young little man. Oh, you haven't yet tasted of life's bitterness, my dove, my sweet child. Right now, your life's blessed. Some day you'll encounter old age and sadness. You'll go to mine coal amidst darkness and rubble. You'll fight death and will struggle. But now sweetly sleep, like in heaven, my child. God will make things all right. Sleep, my dear baby. Good night. From the depths of the night, some people appear. Mother answers the door and trembles with fear. Don't cry, poor lady, they comforted her. Your husband's breathed his last breath. In the depths of the earth, he valiantly worked. In the depths of the earth, he met a quick death. Oh, what a terror the mind suddenly shook. A flame blazed in a terrible shock. In a deafening blast, the walls then collapsed, and they all were buried in piles of rocks. Everyone died. Only we survived, amongst the smoke and the cries and the strife. We found your husband just barely alive. With sadness, he quietly asked for his wife. Help me, my dear, my life's almost done. And the last words he whispered were meant for his son. Sweetly sleep, like in heaven, my child. God will make things all right. Sleep, my dear orphan. Good night.
And And make sure to check out our photo essay about Maanoi City. You'll see photos of all the people and places you heard on our show. You can find the photos online at keystonecrossroads.org/grapple. Next time on Grapple, we'll hear about several other places similar to Maanoi City and what their prospects are. Cheryl Gay Stolberg, who's the New York Times Mid-Atlantic Bureau Chief, and Planet Money founder and writer Adam Davidson will tell us about their recent work in distressed areas. Grapple is a co-production of Cuvenda Media and Keystone Crossroads, a public media initiative covering both challenges and solutions for distressed cities. Support for Keystone Crossroads comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The music on our show is composed by Tony Trove and Mike Vivas. Special thanks to our reporters, Lindsay Lazarski and Emily Previty, and to WHYY's Al Banks for engineering our show, and Charlie Kyer for his help post-production. Our executive producer is Stephanie Marudis of Cuvenda Media. And I'm Naomi Starobin, editor of Keystone Crossroads. Thanks for listening.